already have members of the committee present. I think it allows us to start the meeting.
Yes, sir.
Do you want to deal with your administrative letters first? And then open up the meeting. Are you satisfied?
Yes, I am. I think the only matter to put on record really is a request by Mr. M. Singh, who has joined the meeting, but has informed me that he will be in another meeting at the same time. So he will be here and elsewhere. And that's the only apology he received.
Yeah, all right, Mr.
I'm going to give you my left ear and the other meeting my right ear, Chairman. I'm trying to get my item on the other meeting up high so I can join you. No, when this meeting was changed to 3 o'clock, it just upset my program and this stuff.
No,
I will contribute.
Thank you. Well, colleagues, we then start with our meeting to welcome all those who are in attendance, mainly the members of the committee for the trouble that they've taken. I know that the afternoon Friday is a very difficult time. Parliament seeks to push its own work as we are standing to step down in the the 19th of March as part of the first quarter work. So Parliament is pushing hard that the committee is supposed to deal with their work, and we are part of such, and let me therefore appreciate that we have managed to make this time to have our meeting Friday, and welcome the office of the AG, who has us together with her team. They are crisscrossing the country to various provinces to finalize one of the critical elements, meeting their stakeholders to ensure that when they table the FMA audits, they would have finalized that a kind of an element which is critical in the finalization of their own audits. I know very well that in the morning she had to be in one of the provinces, and therefore we had to have our meeting at this time. The sole engagement with us is to finalize strategy, as we did indicate earlier on by December, that will give the new Auditor General time to integrate new thoughts, ideas, in as far as the strategy is concerned. I understand there are other two policy instruments which they are coming up with for minor amendments, which they would want to take us through on those as a necessity. Welcome to you all, ladies and gentlemen, members of the media, our staff in this meeting. If you agree, colleagues, as you have noted, the Honourable Member Singh's apology, which we appreciate and noted, I'm from another meeting as well, which is continuing now. I had to apologize for that meeting and a number of other members meeting which has started at 2 o'clock, which is still continuing. I hope that others are going to join us. First, appreciate that all members have honored that we have to have this kind of a meeting. Do you want to flash the agenda or let me summarily deal with it in the sense I've done. That agenda of today is the Office of the Auditor General mainly tabling to us as a matter of a presentation their science plan 2021-2024. And with relation to that, as I have cited, there are two policy areas they would want us to have sight on, which are mainly within their own internal management related processes. That's the specific issues of our main attention. So can we take note and agree on the agenda item, colleagues? Is that fine? Can we continue?
Yes, Chair, continue.
Thank you very much. Can we allow the Office of the AG? AG? Office of the AG, they have pledged their presentation to start with a presentation. How about you, AG?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and a good afternoon to all of the honorable members of SCOREC that are on the call, as well as the members of staff of both offices that are on this call. Chair, I want to start by thanking you for the opportunity for me to apply my mind to the strategic plan and budget, given my new seat in the institution, because indeed when one sits in a different seat, you do see things slightly differently. So we would have consulted with you on the strategic plan earlier than this, but I am eternally grateful that you've given me the opportunity to reflect on it. I confirm that the draft has been submitted to the National Treasury as required by the provisions of the Public Audit Act. When I met with you as a committee, honourable members, a few weeks ago, I indicated that we would choose to continue with the 4B strategy for the year starting the 1st of April 2021. And that was because we felt we needed to take time to really consider all of the changes that are happening around us and shape the new strategy that would take us into the next 7 or 10 year journey. So at this point, we are sharing with you a shorter term plan, one which deals in substantive ways with the year that's going to start on the 1st of April 2021. And it is informed by the 4B strategy, which I have the fortune of having been a part of crafting and executing over a great number of years. So I'll talk about that, and I'll talk about the budget and then the directives as well as the complaints policy. If I just deal with the strategic direction for a moment. As the current stewards of the institution, it is our responsibility to protect and safeguard the gains that have been made by others and use those as a launch pad to drive increased relevance of the work of the AAT. Ensure that what we do has an increased impact on the lived experiences of our people. In order to achieve that, we're going to have to indeed take time to consider all of the big shifts that are happening around us. There is significant turbulence around us, high levels of uncertainty, and growing complexity as we contend with growing expectations of the public, but also the general pressures of operating in an environment that's as uncertain as what we're operating in now. So we're going to lean into the benefit of stability and continuation, and we're going to focus on the 4Bs as the centerpiece for the year ahead as we shape the next journey going forward. And that next journey will be informed by this vision of driving increased relevance of our work. The context within which we're operating, as I'm indicating, is the one that is seized with immense complexity, with growing risks and a need for us to continue to respond to those risks. When we listen to the expectations of stakeholders and citizens, we are seized with a sense that we've got to continue with providing high quality work, addressing our deadlines, and make sure that we don't perpetuate the disruptions to the accountability cycle which have been caused by the past year's pandemic as well as the lockdown, which may continue into this new year. We have to find ways to mitigate that. We are called upon to respond with greater urgency to the need to automate and to drive digital transformation in the work that we do. And we have to do that within a context of a very tight fiscal environment. The spotlight on the ATSA continues as the public expects that we will continue to play a growing role in enhancing governance and accountability. And indeed, the Public Audit Act amendments with the new powers that we have raised that expectation, and we have to rise to the challenge. So even with this subdued economic environment, we are seized with finding ways to respond to all of the challenges and all of the expectations that have been expressed by different stakeholders. So if we use the 4D strategy as an anchor point in terms of what we will focus on over the course of the year, I will share with you in respect of each of the 4Bs, the key commitments that we're making, the targets against which we will measure ourselves, and then I will talk about the strategic initiatives that we will implement so that we can realize our objectives and make good on the commitments that we are sharing with you today. On value-add itself, we will continue to look for ways to deepen our knowledge of the business of the entities that we operate, that we audit, make sure that we increase what we know about the environments within which they are expected to perform and understand even to a greater extent the value chains within which they operate. We will look to use data analytics and other methods to deepen this insight so that which we emerge with, whether it is about a designed, specialized audit plan, an audit program, or about specific types of audits that we would engage with, will be informed by this quest to respond to the environment within which our auditees engage. We'll continue to look for ways to improve our audit quality. As you well know, this has been an area that we've needed to do some work on, so we'll continue with the drive to make those necessary improvements. And also, this past year has taught us a few things of the challenges that arise when you're trying to audit remotely in a way that you've never done before. To use all of those lessons to deepen what we do around driving improvements on audit quality, appreciating all the time the centrality of audit quality in terms of us protecting our reputation as an audit office. We're well aware of the expectation that we'll continue to play a role in the governance structure or the accountability process where SOEs are concerned, so our initiatives give some sense of that continuation of the journey. And on the integration of the different disciplines of auditing, we've had a journey that started way back in 2012, and little did we know that the journey of integrating the different disciplines and shaping our audit responses so that we get the very best from the different skills in an audit team, we didn't know that that was preparing us for what would come in 2020. We were able to respond by deploying those multidisciplinary teams and conduct those real-time audits, which have become quite the flagship of 2020. So we will use the lessons we've learned and deepen that work. As I said, the journey we've undertaken for many years, it has stood us in good stead. What we will do is make sure that we never go back in terms of the ground we've already covered. The measures we will use to assess our performance will still be the same as what you've seen before. It will be about the AG assessing the organization's performance on value add, looking at the whole of government approach as well as looking at the specific aspects of the feedback from stakeholders in terms of the type of messaging and value adding insights that we're able to share. We'll continue with implementing the PAA, and I'll share some insights of the type of actions that we're putting in place for this year as we deepen the work that we're doing on implementing the PAA. As you will recall, when we started this journey, we had a deliberate and systematic approach to implementing the definition as well as making choices about where we implement this process. Another measure would be value add in terms of special reports on the table. We've listened to you carefully as the Honourable Members of Parliament and understood only too well that your expectation is that you will build on that which you've done before so that you can get relevant insights to conduct much more proactive oversight work as you go forward. And then we'll also measure our quality, our audit quality in a way that's consistent with prior years. The specific initiatives that we will undertake include, first of all, the implementation of the PAA. This year, for the first time, we will implement the full definition of the MI. As you may recall, when we started, we implemented a part of the definition around non-compliance, and we didn't deal with fraud and theft or breach of fiduciary duty. And on the impact, we looked only at financial loss. That was for the first phase. Then in the second phase, which was the 1920 audit, we covered fraud and theft as well as non-compliance, and then we included, we kept financial loss as the only part of the impact to look at. We are learning a few things having implemented the second phase, and now we're realizing that embracing the full definition could allow us to create even greater value in terms of how that instrument can impact the environment around transparency and accountability and as well as safeguarding of resources. So we will implement the full definition. And on the other hand, we will increase the number of auditees. Not too much. We will try hard not to increase it too much. We've got 89 in the first in phase two. That came from 16 in phase one, and I'm just talking about PFMA. PFMA phase one had 16, PFMA phase two had 89. So PFMA phase three, which will commence on the 1st of April 2021, will have 94 orders. So we've kept all the ones that we had. We've just added on a few that we believe will make, that we believe lend themselves to the implementation of this. I'm aware that the expectation would have been that go ahead and implement all of this everywhere. However, the nature of the year that we've had, Honourable Members, warrants that we be much more vigilant in how we protect the resources we have so that we can respond to different expectations while still driving the systematic shift in implementing this instrument, learning from it, and enhancing it as we go. Talking about enhancements on how we're going to approach it, this year we will be looking at the capacity that supports the proper implementation of this. What we're learning is that we've invested in different spaces and we're starting to see elements that need strengthening, which is a really natural part of any journey of implementing something new. So we're going to use this time to respond to that. And it may well be that we look at the regulations as well, and in that regard we will come to you if there are changes we would like to propose to the regulations. The other aspect of our work will be about intensifying the use of data analytics so that the audit messages that we generate have the benefit of us applying our lens across all of government. And that's something that is a privileged position to have as a Supreme Audit Institution and one that we must use to benefit the journey of driving greater performance of government institutions as well as the safeguarding of resources. On the SOE, the Honourable Members may recall that this is the very first year in which we are going to be auditing Transnet on our own, in that we're taking the primary responsibility to sign it off. Up until now, we've been working in partnership and collaboration with the appointed private sector auditor who took the sign-off responsibility. And that gave us ample opportunity to get to know the entity and start influencing how they were auditing it. We're now, let's say, we call it the driver's seat. And whilst we might still use expertise to complement our team, expertise that comes from private sector audit firms, we will be taking the A for finding that audit. So what that does in terms of having included Transnet for the first time this year, it means the only audit team that doesn't have AGSA sign-off that sits on the Schedule 2 of SOE is EFCOM. of the large entities, it really is ESCOM that isn't being signed off by the Office of the AG. And that's one we have to gear up for in a gradual and measured and deliberate way that you have not seen us do before. This year, however, we will be deploying some of our AGSA resources to complement the team that is appointed by ESCOM, the private sector owners are appointed by ESCOM, so that first of all we get to learn a bit more about the entity, but we can influence and strengthen what they do so that it becomes closer to what we would want to see as the Supreme Audit Institution. And lastly, around value add, our focus will be on improving audit quality. One of the exciting initiatives is about implementing the ISQM, which is really the international standard for quality management, which sees an entity, a firm, looking right across its enterprise for all the things that affect audit quality, so that one is not looking to fix audit quality in a portfolio or within an audit file, but rather we are deliberate about understanding what are the things that we need to fix proactively so that we can drive systemic improvement in audit quality. I turn now to visibility for impact, which is the second V that you've come to know. And this one really is about how we engage proactively and even at the end of the audit cycle, but how we engage with accounting officers, with executive authorities, with oversight, with citizens, with professional bodies, but anybody who has a vested interest in seeing us make gains in the journey towards improving governance. And using those interactions to inspire people to do what we think is important if we are going to improve internal controls and therefore the performance of different entities in government. So we will continue to deepen our conversations around the key controls, and we'll make sure that the journey and the conversation around preventative internal controls gains momentum. In terms of educating citizens and empowering them, we aim to deepen the work that we've been doing and also look for opportunities to collaborate with civil society organizations in the course of our work, because certainly the COVID work has taught us a few things about what is possible if we collaborate even better than what we have done before. Our audit teams themselves, we are only acutely aware. We are acutely aware of the threats that they have to contend with and the need for us to equip them with the capacity and the tools to carry out our mandates without having to fear anyone, without having to run the risk of...
So part of
the reason why we put this issue around threat and intimidation in the context of visibility is because we do believe that we've got to elevate the manner in which we engage with other agencies in government that can help us to protect our team. And we want to include this as part of the initiatives in our visibility plan. And then on the international front, we will continue with supporting AFOSID in its activities around supporting the development and strengthening of Supreme Audit institutions on the continent, especially around African-speaking countries. And we also continue to participate in the various enterprise structures and initiatives, all of which are really aimed at benefiting the global community of practice amongst the Supreme Audit institutions. And we find that there is mutual benefit. Not only are we investing, but we get the benefit associated with those global interactions. The measures we'll use to assess our gains in this regard will be the same as what you've seen, with an assessment that internally focused around what the AG sees as how the organization has engaged with the visibility program, because we get the benefit of external input that the AG gets directly. We will look at how we've implemented our improvement plan in terms of the visibility drive especially amongst constitutional stakeholders. Over the last few years, we've made it a habit to get regular feedback from the portfolio committees as well as over in Parliament so that we get better at how we present ourselves and how we provide information to those committees. And then, of course, we'll continue to engage with citizens as I indicated. The initiatives that will support that in many ways I've spoken to those, but just to highlight that where the proactive engagements with accounting officers are concerned, we're going to build on the preventative controls guidance that we launched last year. We said we would follow up with another one, so we will do that, and we'll give them the work we're doing on the status of their purchases. Then, of course, there's a part about collaborating with different bodies that are interested in the work of the office and can complement what we do. These days, they're engaged in the investigative space or around law enforcement. Then, on the international participation program, I think I've spoken to that as well. So I move now swiftly to viability. And I know that we're going to spend a bit of time on the budget, but just to shape the viability story so that we give it to you in its completeness. When we deal with viability and sustainability, many of our eyes go towards finances and then people and then the IT environment. So in terms of finances, in the context that we're operating in, the judicious use of resources is a key part of what we're doing. Making sure we generate adequate revenue without putting too much pressure on the fiscus so that the affordability of our fees doesn't become out of reach for auditees themselves who are under severe budgetary pressure. And we will continue our drive to collect audit fees whilst containing our own costs, our own operating costs. And then in terms of the IT environment, our aim is to drive greater investment in IT, specifically around audit-related tools. That's been a journey, and I think we are getting ready to make a step change in that regard. The professionalization journey continues, and we will drive continuous improvement on the skills of our people. Over the last 2 years, we've spent a great deal of time driving technical training, but also training around the PAA amendments and the MI process. We really just need to continue on that so that we reinforce that which we built and make sure that the new people also get the benefit of that growing training. And then on the use of resources, one of the things we do want to drive is increased innovation, but also increased leadership attention to how we can best use resources, because we do have to become more efficient. We can't drive relevance on the one hand and be tone deaf to the fortunes of the audities that we aim to serve. The goals that we have and the targets that we're going to drive, what you'll see in the next slide is that the net surplus that we're targeting is the upper range of 0% and the lower range of minus 2%. And I'm going to explain that when I get to the budget. So if you could just put a pin in it, because I'm well aware that that is unusual. And the cash margin that we're driving, which is a feature of our target and has been for quite a while now, will be on the upper end of 2 months and then 1.5 months on the lower end, which really is talking to the budgetary pressures that we're facing. And as I indicated, I will deal with that in more detail when I deal with the budget. We'll also get the external rating in terms of how our training officers stack up against the sidecar accreditation requirements. And that's quite important for us because it's an important indicator of how we're tracking in the development of talent internally, even though it's on the lower level, and because it also informs how attractive we are as a destination for young people who want to build careers in the profession, and also a wonderful marketing tool for the retention of talent even at the more senior levels. And the benefit of it is that it's an external measure, so we're not just talking to ourselves. Internally, we aim to roll out new values that we've been working on for about a year and a half now. So that creates a platform for us to drive greater staff engagement, which we learn to appreciate is ever more critical when we are all operating remotely and are unable to see each other. The responsibilities that leaders have to take on around keeping staff engaged have increased ever so much. And then on the IT side, it's really about driving a business plan on all the software. We've been struggling with this for a while for a couple of reasons. One is that the software we had hoped would be upgraded to a level that would suit us, and that turned out not to be the case, and we've had to deal with that. Two, changing for the software has a significant bearing on the audit machinery, so we have to be ever so careful and make sure we're making the right decision about the software we're choosing, the right decision in terms of our ability to afford it in terms of the software itself, but also afford it in terms of the transition costs associated with it, because we simply can't let the machinery down. So it will take us some time to get the roadmap down tight so that we are confident about the decision we do make. Of course, another limitation has been about cash resources, but we are finding innovative ways of funding that program and setting aside some of our accumulated surplus as we collect it to make sure we can pay for it. And then on the strategic initiative chair, I think I've spoken to these as I went along. The only one I might not have dealt with is the one about our investments in infrastructure and other IT programs just to support the ongoing journey of people working from home, of people working more efficiently in the office. And then the other one is about optimizing the own hours so that we don't give away all of our margin or too much of our margin as we contract out. However, this particular initiative will be quite challenging over the next period because we are catching up on the order cycles that became quite late. So as we're trying to catch up and deal with these order deadlines that have shifted and with a difficult operating environment, we're going to have to open up and give some more work to CWC, which will take away some margin, but we're watching it very closely so that it does not erode our sustainability. I turn to the very last V, the fourth one, and this fourth V, which is called Vision and Values Driven, deals with three aspects. One is about clean administration for our own office and good governance for our own office. So are we running our own environment in the way we expect others to do? The other one is about ethical conduct. Are we driving proper ethics awareness programs and training around that and making sure our teams are acutely aware of the ethical risks that confront them and are quick to deal with them? And also, are we driving the right controls internally to pick up on potential risks to ethical behavior and be able to respond to that? Then the third area of this fourth B is about transformation. And it's really about saying we are a corporate citizen in South Africa today. We share responsibility that we expect any other corporate citizen to have, and so we've got to make a contribution towards transformation. And we focus our efforts in this regard on the accountancy profession. The measures would be a triple B level 2 this year. That's the target. Last year we achieved level 1. So the team tells me that level 2 will be a stretch because it is just so hard in an environment when we're not operating in a normal way. However, I have put a carrot for them to still reach for that level 1. A non-negotiable goal is the external audit opinion, which must be a clean audit, and I'm sure that the honorable members would expect absolutely nothing less. And then, of course, it's also the responsiveness to any ethical breaches that might arise. And our initiatives are pretty much what you would have seen before, our enterprise development program to support emerging black firms, our program to support communities where our teams operate through the social and economic development initiative, and our program to support other suppliers, whether it's through, you know, pick-up payment terms so that the viability of the smaller businesses isn't compromised, and then driving ongoing development of the skills within our environment. On the ethics front, Last year we had an independent ethics maturity assessment, which gave us a very strong rating, a double A plus rating, one that we are immensely proud of. However, we are not complacent. We've taken on board some of the recommendations that were pointed out, and what we decided to do is to focus this year on driving more timely management of complaints as they arise, but also to strengthen our leadership's ability to own and drive their own ethical behavior, because we know that younger people, more junior people, follow that which they see. Honorable Chair, I'd like to move on now to the budget, because I promised I would deal with it more substantively when we dealt with VP. We enter this budget cycle, Chair, with a myriad of issues, an economic outlook that remains fluid, and one where it is difficult to forecast with any reasonable degree of certainty, particularly in the light of COVID-19. With speculation rife that we may have to contend with a third or even fourth wave, we expect the year ahead to be extremely challenging, as the economic recovery is likely to be protracted. As an organization, we've been on a journey to stabilize our finances. The prudence that we displayed in previous years stood us in good stead over the turbulence of the 2021 financial year. And we believe that we continue to learn lessons that will indeed serve as things that bolster us as we deal with a more challenging 2022 year. In the main, in 2021, we lost audit time in the first quarter, which had an impact on the rollout of audits and our financial performance. And the honorable members may recall our conversation with you in the middle of last year. Our efforts were expended on preserving cash flows at the time, and one of the radical things we did last year was to freeze salaries and to freeze bonuses. So the staff of the Office of the AG last year did not see an increase, and they did not see a growth. And I may have indicated to you when we last met that we know that that is an unsustainable way in which to operate. But it had to be done. We were responding to a crisis. This decision, as radical and as unpopular as it was, helped us to contain internal overhead, but it also helped us to contain any audit fee increases that we were passing on to auditees. Effectively, with a 0% increase of the payroll, our audit clients had a 0% increase on their audit fees. And that was our contribution towards making our audit fees more affordable and easing the burden on our various auditees right across the country. Despite this change, despite this radical decision, which I'm aware we can't repeat, our funding model remains resilient. We remain self-funded as an institution, bolstered by the prudence and vigilance of prior years. This budget for 2022 has factored in the catch-up on audit, together with increased spending that we must make so that we augment our resourcing by insourcing CWC firms. So what I'm saying there is that we've adjusted our income and our profitability to take account of the fact that we will outsource slightly more than we've done before, just so that we can have the resources to complete our audit on time. However, we'll do that in a very controlled way. So our base revenue line will increase by a 4%, which is in line with inflation. However, a combination of the catch-up audits from 2021, as well as spillover audits from even the previous financial year, drives an increase in our audit fees to a level of 7%. And that 7%, the margin, so the difference between 4% and 7% is the catch-up audit, plus also the additional hours associated with newer audits, such as Transmit. Operational costs will only grow by 1.7%, and this is due to cost containment tactics such as the headcount moratorium.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Bye.
The cost containment strategies that we implemented include a headcount moratorium, the optimization of virtual working arrangements, as well as us translating a reduction in spend, especially on areas such as subsistence and travel costs. So the benefit of people working from home and engaging in the way that we're doing now is that we've been able to save on costs associated with that travel. So I know that our budget for 2021, as you look at it, shows a net deficit of 67 million rand, which is completely undesirable. And in order to protect ourselves from that, we will continue our engagement with the National Treasury to support us, especially on two things: the further costs associated with the PA implementation, as well as the costs associated with the COVID order. Honourable members will remember that at the last meeting, the Chair reported that the National Treasury had made good on the 50 million that we had initially requested. And that came through to a few weeks ago, so it goes into the 2021 financial year. We therefore are going to continue engagement specifically on support for those COVID-19 orders. And I think if we meet that, we will certainly be in a break-even position. So it's not a budget that we are particularly proud of. We've taken the time to consider all of our different options, and we are putting that 57 million deficit here so that we are transparent and we demonstrate that we intend to maintain our level of operation, our level of effectiveness, even in these difficult times. And you place it there to demonstrate the importance of us maintaining this collaborative relationship with the National Treasury. I turn now to the slide on CAPEX. Honourable Chair, the budget also reflects our continued desire to modernize and transform our business in order to create the required efficiency that will reduce audit costs in the future. We will invest in ICT infrastructure, computer software, as well as computer hardware that will drive the automation of essential business processes. And we will fund much of this CAPEX through an effective drawdown on the accumulated surpluses. Year after year, you have allowed us to retain surpluses. And you've done that because we put a plea about our journey of investing particularly on infrastructure. So we will draw down on that retained income. I'm aware that we still continue to experience major challenges in translating the retained surpluses into cash, as these funds are often tied up in long outstanding debt, especially in the local government space, and also in those entities that are financially distressed, including a number of the SOEs. In 1819, as well as 1920, in those years, we funded the following key projects from the retained surpluses, just so that you're aware that we do use these surpluses in the way that we say we will. We invested in our infrastructure programs, we invested in notebooks, as well as software, and we also invested in IT security enhancements. And we also invested in the leasehold improvements associated with our shift to a new head office. You may recall, honourable members, that about a year ago we reported to you that we were making significant progress in finding new premises, which would see us vacating the Pretoria campus, which houses the head office, as well as all of the audit teams that service the national government. And we've been in that office for over 10 years and had long outgrown it and have been on a program to find new premises for a great deal of time. We've now spent that money that we have been requesting your permission to retain. Also in the budget, and the expenditure on accumulated surpluses. We've used some of the money to invest in the capacity that helps us to implement our new extended power, whether it was about investing in specialized skills, forensics, data analysts, IT auditors, and the like. We've also done extensive training for our team, and we've also created a team to work on material irregularities in training. Some of the surplus have also been applied towards the normal training of our staff so that they are equipped to engage with a multifaceted public sector environment. They are effective in driving impactful communication and engagement, that our leaders internally are equipped to engage with the leadership duties and responsibilities that are particularly complex as we move forward. And we've also used the opportunity to invest in technical training on financial reporting framework as well as auditing standards. So Honourable Chair, that is our story on the budget, and no doubt the Honourable Members will have a few comments on what we've presented. The last part of my input today covers two areas, as the Honourable Chair said. One is the audit directive, and the other one is the complaints policy. The Public Audit Act in Section 13 requires the Auditor General to consult SCOAC in the course of determining the standards for audits, the frequency, nature, and scope of such audits, as well as procedures for handling complaints when we perform such audits. And these matters we normally include in an audit directive, which is provided for in the Public Audit Act. The last directive that we tabled and ultimately gazetted following our consultation with SCOAC was on the 5th of May 2020. In 2021, we anticipate that we will make very small changes. So the directive, which we submitted to you in both a clean copy of a new directive, but also have given you a marked-up version of the old one so that you can track the changes fairly easily. There are two changes. There's one about the scope of the audits of compliance, which responds to our need to whittle down somewhat some of the compliance issues that we would have wanted to test, especially in the area of HR. The Public Service Commission does a great deal of work in that environment, and many SCOPAs in particular get regular briefings on the work that the Public Service Commission does in that area. And so we scope that down for this year. We are in consultation with the DPSA around some of the work that they would like us to do as part of a collaborative effort that will support them on the policy changes that they are wanting to effect. And we will do that once we finalize the consultation with them. So what I'm demonstrating here, Chair, is that the reduction in the scope on HR audit is in response to the need for us to minimize duplication of effort and to optimize effective collaboration between different players in the system. And here I've mentioned the PSC, so we decided not to duplicate their efforts. And I've mentioned DPSA, who say, well, maybe there are different ways of looking at this thing, so let's talk. So we've reduced those areas. The other area that we've reduced is on, the other change on the audit directive, I beg your pardon, is that we've set out in this directive that we are going to be applying the full definition of the MR regulation, which I indicated earlier on. So those are the changes in the audit directive. The next three slides talk to the specifics of the changes that we're making, but it's essentially on those two fronts. The complaints policy check, again, Section 13 indicates that the AG must consult with SOAS on any changes we make to the complaints handling policy. And so our submission to you today will map out the key elements of how we handle complaints internally, but also socialize you on the proposed policy changes. I'm not sure, Chair, I will seek your counsel on how the committee would like to engage with this going forward, but I will take less than 5 minutes to take you through what these changes are. We've revised the complaints policy, and that was because we needed to respond to a recommendation from our own audit committee. And they recommended that we ought to have in our own complaints policy a clause that highlights how any complaints that are made against members of oversight structures within the NGSA are handled. So essentially they say, you have REMCO, you have audit committee, you have committees that the AG can appoint to advise her. We would want to make sure that your complaints policy is clear and deliberate in setting out how any complaints that come out around conduct of any of these members who are not employed by the AG but are doing work on behalf of the AG as part of these committees, we want to know and we want the public to know exactly how you're going to deal with that. So together with this recommendation that came from the audit committee, we took the chance to review the policy in its entirety and factor in some of the things that we've been picking up in the current environment. Often auditees will complain about not really understanding our complaints process and how they'll also complain about the timelines that we take to respond to complaints. But also some of them believe that our complaints handling process is not independent or that it's not transparent. So we thought, if we clarify the processes that underpin the complaint handling journey, that will drive us towards doing away with any perception or reality even of bias in how we're handling complaints or even unfairness. So the specific changes in the definitions, and we've given you the policy, so these two slides just tell you where the changes are. The definition just introduces the topic about the oversight structure, the host committee, REMCO, the advisory structures. The next one deals with how we're going to deal with complaints that come through the whistleblowing channel. We didn't have a whistleblowing channel until about 2 years ago. So this policy update just deals with how we would channel those complaints that come through that mechanism. Because some policies come straight into the institution, directed at the team that deals with complaints, but others choose to use the whistleblowing facility that's handled by third parties, and those come through to us. So it's really just about giving expression to how they'd be handled. The next change deals with just clarifying to auditees who want to table a complaint a key issue that we would want you to exhaust the internal escalation process as set out in your engagement letter with the audit team. So when the audit commences, there's an engagement letter between the audit engagement manager, the senior manager here at the AG, and the accounting officer at the audit team. And that sets out a number of key principles, one of those being, if there are problems or complaints, how do we deal with them? And whom do we escalate matters to? And we find that that gives a great deal of certainty and order into the process. And so we've highlighted that expectation that clients or auditees must make sure that they exhaust that process first. And if indeed they have not been satisfied in terms of how the matter has been resolved, then they can enter this complaints policy. So it's really just about clarifying that process. The next change deals with how we would deal with category 3 complaints, those that relate to employees in the AGSA. And really it's just about expanding the clause so that complaints that are issued against oversight structure members, the board committees, etc., are also captured in how we would deal with those. And the last change introduces GOAC as a player in how we would deal with complaints that are made against members of advisory structures. And I need to explain this a little bit. The Auditor General appoints the members of Audit Committee of REMCO and the advisory structure. So if there's a complaint, all we're saying is that the The complaint must go to the Auditor General as the appointing authority for them, and it must at the same time go to FOAS as part of the accountability mechanism, so that FOAS has line of sight on how these complaints are being handled and that things are not lost in the past. And that's really all it's all it does. The last two slides, Chair, are just about the how we manage the process internally. I don't propose to go through those because I think it's just about reminding the honourable members about what currently sits in the policy. These have not been changed. It's just about reminding you of how we currently deal with complaints. If there's a need to do so, I'm happy to do so. But I just thought if I can focus on what we're looking to do here today, which is to highlight the key changes we're making around the complaints policy. And with that, Chair, I have completed my input for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, AG, for such a presentation, which has stretched between the strategy and some policy instruments, which need our eye and our consent one way or the other. As colleagues, you are listening, it becomes so critical to take note of the fact that how the Office of the Auditor General seeks as a point of emphasis to pursue the audits and stretch them even into the levels of state-owned entities which have never been in their realm in terms of the audit function. And that stretch would as well seek to permeate the environment of the elements of the PA review, which emphasizes the MI process. And therefore enhancing the capability of the Office of the Auditor General, there is that kind of emphasis as we have been listening in as far as the strategy is concerned. That is as well seek to be strengthened by the fact that there are some mechanisms which serve to stress the quality aspect of the audit outcomes, and therefore the entirety of the process in scale, which begins to give credence into the independence of the office, and as well from our side, more appropriately, the protection of that office to continue to do its own work without fear or favor. And as you have been listening, colleagues, there has been an element which is covers technology, covered the warm bodies, and stretch even towards the financial angle. And on the financial angle, the AG has emphasized the deficit of 57 million with a rider that sought to put a term to the fact that there are still some engagements between National Treasury based on the Public Audit Act funding, which we have appreciated for it to continue beyond the current financial year, and as well looking into financing the COVID-19 audit expenditure. And then thereafter, we would have some appreciation on the matters which sought to look into the policy environment, which relate to audit directives and as well the complaints policy. There is a presentation, colleagues. Are there any comments, questions, of clarity or comments from the members, as we would as well have time to deal with these matters in the finalization of this report for being tabled to Parliament not later than the end of this month, which is March. Open for discussion.
Okay, I see three hands.
I see hands there. The first hand comes from Mayor Veronica Mante. The second one comes from Honourable Member Constance Chepesangwe. And the third one comes from Honourable Hanif Hussein. These are the three hands.
Yes, sir.
That's right. Mohammed. Honorable Mohammed.
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chair. And good afternoon to AG and everyone. I only have two things I want to find out, which the AG touched on them, but I would like her to expand. With the year of 2020, which we're coming out of, and its challenges, it therefore demanded that governance policing entities like AG should come up with new strategies in terms of monitoring the expenditures across our government. Now, she spoke about the whistleblowing line. That's one of the elements that and tools that can be used in order to ensure that we technologically we use the space in order to get to curb the scourge of corruption. But I want her to expand on the in terms of the whistleblowing line. Remember that now we deal with a very advanced technology era. And what mechanisms are there in the whistleblowing line? And also, is it then the whistleblowing line aligned to some sort of a real-time audit? Real-time audit that I mean is that, for instance, how you have now audited the budget of the COVID-19 and how you managed to follow it up quickly in order to stop unnecessary expenditure of it and ensuring that there is no gap or there are no open opportunities for the policies of government to not be followed properly, and in terms of financial expenditure and all the regulations that are there are followed, the PFMA is followed, treasury regulations are followed. So is your line on whistleblowing aligned to the real-time audit? And then my second concern, if that's so, is there enough personnel and you have a much more strengthened system to resolve the cases as they get reported? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The next person, Mamu Constance.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is also, I'm just going to raise two questions. We know that in the previous financial year there was serious intimidation for our auditors, and a number of cases were reported to the police. I just want to know if you still experience the same problem, and also to find out from the department, from the AG, about their citizen engagement. How are they going to do that under these circumstances which we find ourselves in? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mamu Constance, and we go to Honorable Anif.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Thank you very much also to the AG for the information that she has shared with us. I have one or two comments and just possibly two questions, Chairperson. May I say firstly, Chair, that I think that the AG's office has established a reputation over the years in our country to be quite an effective institution, and something that I think that the country is generally proud of, because annually you will find that the Auditor General will address the nation and put out some sort of a status report on municipalities and government departments, and so ordinary taxpayers get an indication through the Auditor General's office just how well their money is being used. And whenever that happens, Chairperson, there's generally an outcry in the country around the high levels of irregular expenditure, corruption, what is famously referred to as UIFW, unauthorized, irregular, footless, and wasteful expenditure. And all of us have seen over the years there's been a constant increase on those figures in almost every government department. Well, there are a few of them that are good performers. And of course, as they usually say, you don't thank the fish for swimming. But those ones who don't perform well and who are constantly on the decline are the are those departments that I'm specifically concerned about. And so, Chair, my issue is not around the manner in which the Auditor General conducts their processes, conducts their audits. I think we can all be proud about that. And I think that this report actually gives us even more confidence on their ability to be able to do their job. Excuse me. Where I take issue, Chairperson, is the result and the outcome of those audits. It's well and good having a report annually saying, this is how well you have performed in these areas, and these are the areas where you have performed badly. But when nothing happens year on year on year to those departments and to those individuals who are directly responsible for that UIFW, then people lose hope even in the institution itself, because it then becomes a tiger with no teeth. And just recently, Chairperson, there was a law that was passed that gives the Auditor General even more powers in respect of the cost recovery. And I would like to ask the AG, I've listened to the presentation very carefully, and what I'm not seeing is anywhere in that report that a very high level of prominence be placed on the principle of accountability and holding people accountable for the outcomes, the audit outcomes itself. So it's fine to do the audits as they are, and that's the job of the AG. But what do we do with that information thereafter when people steal money? What do we do with that information thereafter when people are not doing the job that they're getting paid a very handsome salary for every single month? And I really want to get and I raised this issue at the previous meeting, and I will continuously raise it, because there's no point in us being able to point out where the weaknesses are if we're not going to take action against those individuals who are responsible for those weaknesses. So, AG, we are proud of your institution, but we will be even more proud if you can show to the country and to this portfolio committee that you're serious about holding people accountable through the powers that have just been granted to you in Parliament. I'm not seeing that in your report anywhere, and I'd really like to hear what your thoughts are on it, to give us a sense of confidence that you're going to take that seriously and hold people accountable, so that year on year when you make that report about what the strengths and the weaknesses are of government departments in terms of their financial management, people will get a sense of comfort in the AG's office that you are now a tiger with teeth and you can actually do something about it. The second thing I want to raise, Chairperson, is this issue around the 57 million rand deficit, which to me is really sad. And you know, as the saying usually goes, you get what you pay for. I find a sense of comfort in the AG's comment that they will draw down that 57 million rand from reserves, if I understood that correctly, so that they make sure that the level of quality of the service that they provide and the auditing that they provide is not affected in any way whatsoever. But notwithstanding that, I do want to add my voice to the fact that if we want to get to a stage of where you really have an institution that has the power to be able to not only audit but to take action whenever you grant them those powers, then they're going to need the resources to be able to do that. And I'm disappointed to hear that there's a 57 million rand deficit, and I wanted to just place that one matter on record. Lastly, Chairperson, as we all are aware, that the AG's office generally conducts sample audits whenever they go into various departments, municipalities, and so on. And I understand that a sample audit is generally only just a portion of what's going on in that particular department. And of course, if you want to get a real picture, you would want to expand the platform that you're conducting that audit. So if you're conducting an audit of only 5% of the activities of that municipality and producing a report, it's not always a very direct indication of exactly what the status of that particular department is. So I do want to hear from the AG, what is the longer-term plan to make sure that the departments that are being audited by the AG's office, that a far wider sample audit is done, so that we get to the real, get to see the real picture of what the state of that municipality is. Because a lot of the corruption in the UIFW is probably even worse than what the AG is suggesting at the moment when you look at the last AG's report, simply because they've only conducted a percentage or a sample of the work that was done by that municipality. So I want to hear a response from the AG on what is the longer-term plan to expand the sample audit so that we get a much more clearer picture of what exactly is going on in various government departments. But thank you very much, Chairperson, to you, and thank you to the AG for the information that she's provided to us. I will stop there. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. In absence of other questions, are there any other members who seek to make contributions?
Chairperson?
Honorable Singh?
Yeah, Chairperson, I am sorry that, you know, I'm in this other meeting and I'm trying to, and please forgive me if these, firstly, will you give me a permission to ask a few questions?
Yeah, allowed.
Yeah, please forgive me if some of these questions have been asked or the AG has made it part of the presentation. But a couple of things maybe the Office of AG needs to comment. We read, Chairperson and colleagues and AG, of certain large accounting firms, some of which are used by the Office of the AG in your outsourcing, of you know, irregularities, etc. To what extent are you and your team keeping an eye on these firms? I know in the past when AG, late Kimi Makwetu was around, bless his soul, we just put a ban on some of those firms. So if you can tell us something about that. Secondly, on the question of outsourcing, to what extent are you going to be reducing the need to outsource? You can't completely stop the need to outsource to other companies, but in terms of your strategic plan, is there a move to do that? And the last question, Chairperson, is the increasing professional capacity in to conduct forensic investigations. Are we still going to rely on outside sources to provide the forensic investigation capacity, or are you trying to build up capacity within the organization itself? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. Is there any other member? One, two, three, four, five, six, no other one. In absence of any other member, AG, they're setting up responses on those questions. Something which I think it will benefit our understanding and a sense of authority. Even to your office, to a bit emphasize on the comparative of your costing of the work which you have done during the COVID-19 audit aspect. And to that effect, you correlate it with what you have somewhat shown in Ireland as the deficit in terms of your budget, because wiseness from our side to allow a budget which shows a sense of deficit without backing of that kind of an amount getting into a positive amount is a bit detrimental. What aspect which you have indicated to us that you are still in negotiations with Treasury on that amount, it could therefore need some form of a specificity for your highlight in the presentation of the budget, and inclusive to that the element that you got into the Public Audit Act funding, which has started already on a 50 million rand. And secondly, focusing on people and the capacity of your office, probably we should pass into the instance of populating the office in various levels, inclusive of the process in as far as the appointments of the deputy or attorney general is concerned, and the national leader. You see, for that, those areas anchor your ability to manage, to lead, and effectively to ensure that the need for qualitative aspects in your leadership are somewhat boldly indicated on the presence in such offices of those individuals. If you could move in such an instance when you respond to these other questions as highlighted by the members. Thank you very much, members. AG?
Thank you very much to the members and to you, Chair, for those questions and that direction on the areas you'd want me to focus on. But let me start with the key matter you raised, and I'll go back to the questions raised by the individual members that spoke. The deficit of 57 million rand would be diminished if we got the 150 million rand, 150 million rand that we spend on executing those real-time audits. When we started the performance year on the 1st of April 2020, there was absolutely no plan to conduct this work. Certainly there was no plan for COVID. And when we got the request from the President for the office to support the assurance provision on these funds, we quickly deployed our resources. And so we have yet to get the benefit of that money back. So that's the piece I was saying we are talking to the Treasury about. So certainly if we got that, we would certainly not be in a deficit situation. So perhaps it was an elegant way of us just highlighting the issue for you. If I could ask that you allow us to continue to engage with the Treasury for a few more weeks, and if we need to, we will lean on you for your support. In terms of the people dynamic, I agree. The point about do we have enough people, I think Honourable Mente asked, do we have enough people to conduct real-time audits all over the spectrum? Certainly not. We don't. Do we have all of the forensic skills that we would like? Not at all. We've recruited, we're building, and I guess these things do take time, and we would need even more than what we have. So that journey continues in terms of finding every opportunity to recruit people, to train our own guys, and to find the capacity to respond to certainly the things that are on our face at the moment. on the DAG role, Honorable Chair, you know that I was appointed with effect from the 1st of December. At that point, I was then able to start recruiting. And of course, we were now at the end of the calendar year, and not much happened in the country between the mid-December and mid-January. But we did advertise almost in the first week, and we've been processing those applications. We are at a point where we are looking at final interviews to happen in the middle of April, which will give us a fairly short space of time within which we can come to the committee. Well, I can come to the committee with a recommendation which the committee can engage with, because I've got to appoint after consultation with the committee. That position having been filled would create a wonderful opportunity for us to smoothly close the existing gaps, especially around the national leader. Some of the constraints we had in the context of COVID last year made it very difficult to fill positions. A combination of lockdown provisions as well as just the sheer uncertainty of managing within a crisis, it just became untenable to be filling, especially the senior level vacancies. However, I appreciate the urgency of doing it, and I want to assure the committee that that work is firmly underway. Let me go to the questions that the honourable members asked in turn. Honourable Mender, do we have a strategy to conduct real-time audits in a broader way? Our strategy so far says that we will find every opportunity to create differentiated audit programs. But it cannot be that we would expect to conduct real-time audits every single auditee. However, there are those that lend themselves to do that. And that's part of our strategy going forward. She said, let's have a differentiated audit program that responds to the risks that we've identified at particular auditees. We couldn't do it for everybody because we still have to conduct the annual regularity year-end audit. We would love to have additional personnel, and indeed we may come back to you with a plan. We will come back to you with a plan, and we may come back to you with requests about how to bulk up in terms of that type of scale and how to shift our machinery towards that direction as well. So that's something that we are working on. The whistleblowing tool, that one is really about complaints of people who want to complain about us internally, or the teams want to complain about our conduct in the course of completing audits, and less about people blowing the whistle on the spend of public funds across different entities. So it doesn't have that natural link to real-time audits. Sometimes people complain and submit complaints about OTs, about conduct at OTs. And what we then do is we process the complaint and we channel it towards the audit team that's responsible for that OT, for them to look at it in substance and determine two things, whether it has any relevance to the audit, and if so, they incorporate it into the audit, or two, whether it needs to be investigated by someone else, and that way we then can refer. So what I'm saying is our tool is really shaped to deal with complaints that are about our institution and our people, but sometimes we do get complaints about the public finance management system, and we channel them in the way that I've described. But certainly we look forward to engaging with you later in the year on our new strategy. Honorable Jeppo Simwe, around intimidation of auditors, I think lockdown helped. When we look at the statistics of incidents of threat and intimidation, we found that the numbers have certainly gone down quite considerably. So we're not seeing it as high. However, we are not complacent. We have not yet reached a point where we can say that that issue is out of our hands. In fact, we think that the drive to implement these material irregularities and issuing these notifications will in time increase the risks of shift and intimidation. One of the critical things we're doing to deal with that proactively is to drive awareness of what this tool does and how we can help accounting officers so that they don't see it as a punitive instrument, but one that corrects
And you're also using the opportunity to educate citizens about what this instrument does and also what our audit outcomes mean and don't mean. And we believe that a combination of these engagements in terms of our citizens and accounting officers on the one hand, but also collaborating with law enforcement agencies, not just to protect our teams, but also for us to refer matters so that it's out of our hands very quickly, will serve to protect our teams. We asked about citizen engagement. I've answered a part of it around driving awareness about the work of the office and how it can help to build trust, the trust that they should have in institutions. And yes, all too often there are things that violate that trust, and we must confront them. But sometimes just driving transparency can help to build much greater levels of trust. The CSOs, three ways: awareness of our work, through webinars and workshops and sharing information. It's also about getting insights on their research, because they're pretty active in the system and it's useful to understand what they're seeing and see how we can enrich what we do and vice versa. And also collaboration on audits, because there are things that they're able to do on the ground around performance of different initiatives that we can collaborate on. Honorable Hussein, the increase on UIFW, I agree with you. And people will lose hope for as long as we don't drive the key things that are going to drive confidence. One, build the controls that are going to limit the instances of these problems. Two, drive accountability when things go wrong. And three, us implementing the amendments. So we can only ever be the last player in the system. Even when we do real-time audits or proactive audits, even when we are swift and effective about implementing our instruments, which we are dedicated to doing, even when we do that, the nature of an audit is that it does come after there's been an implementation of a transaction. The way we're going to have to drive hope is by people seeing improvements on the one hand and consequences on the other hand. And if you follow the story about the special report that we produced last year, hope was reinstilled, because not only were we able to say, well, we've looked at these programs and a few things went wrong, but there were a few problems. And guess what? We've seen the changes that have been made, in that the controls are being improved, the instances of leakage are being diminished, but also where there was leakage, somebody's being held accountable. You've got people going into the dock and you've got money coming back into the system, especially if you look at SASA and the UIA. You've actually seen that. So I do believe that we've got to kick into motion the input and contribution of different players. Yes, the audit office, and we will implement this tool without any fear and without any doubt. We will certainly do that. I just believe that the urgency of this moment requires that we get everyone in the system engaged in this journey. Accounting officers, executive authorities, oversight, the law enforcement agencies, the investigation bodies, so that ultimately you have a machinery that's there to protect resources. And that's when we are going to be able to demonstrate that all of us are serious. For the audit office, I can tell you that we are very serious about implementing this instrument. In the last year, 2 years, we've been able to find 78 material irregularities in the course of our audit, and audits conducted under the most difficult operating circumstances. Is that enough? Certainly not, but it's a very good start, a solid start, and I think we can all be immensely proud of the team that the Office of the AG. Going forward, we will deepen that work. However, we can't wait for a certificate of debt, as important as it is, as a signal of consequences, as a signal that the office has key. It is absolutely important, I agree with you, but we can't simply wait for it. The urgency requires that there be much more action by other players in the system. So we do plan to increase our coverage in terms of the number of audits, but we've got to do that systematically, taking into account all the things that are happening around us. There's a call for real-time audits on the one hand and proactive work. There's a call for engagement, and there's a call for increasing the audit coverage. We only have so much capacity. And even if we increase it tomorrow, the ability of that capacity to drive everything is always going to be diminished, especially if we appreciate that the inherent challenge of an audit or the inherent value of an audit is that it happens after a transaction. There are other people in the chain that ought to be activated. Honorable Singh, I agree with you that the audit firms that we work with have had immense challenges, reputational risk, audit quality issues, irregularities that have been associated with them, and we do keep a very close eye on them. Since the incident of 2017, when we ultimately terminated the audit mandate of KPMG and going to be following the irregularities that were clear in those firms, we upped the level of rigor in terms of our due diligence, in terms of our quality control on the work that's done on our behalf. And what we are seeing, Honorable Singh, is that a number of firms are striving hard to improve matters around ethics, around audit quality, and around reputation management. The work is slow, profession-wise, but the firms we work with, we're seeing that there is a step change in terms of appreciating the need to drive increases in public trust of the profession. And if you look at a firm like KPMG, we've watched the transition in that firm for a great deal of time. And our observation is that they are making a number of very impressive changes in terms of their commitment to audit quality and their commitment to public trust. Some of the announcements have been made public, so I'm not telling you what you don't know already. So we've been watching this for a great deal of time because we are vested in the profession. But in terms of the work that's done on our behalf, we have put in safeguards to ensure that it is not compromised by any challenge within the firm itself. For example, much of our work has shifted into contracting in over many years now. And also we have put in place more monitoring reviews when we've contracted work out. Do we intend to reduce it? 6 years ago, the allocation to CWP set at about 23%. We're currently at about 13%. This year, given the challenges around the audit cycles and the lockdown issues and the delays in audits, we are going to have to increase it, but it won't be to the extent of 2-3%. Going forward, what do I see? Can we do away with it? I don't believe that it's appropriate or necessary to do away with it. One, I think that there is a benefit, a strategic benefit in terms of the cross-pollination of ideas from private sector to public sector auditor. And I also believe that the time frames within which we've got to complete our audit would require that we continue to rely on some capacity from the audit firms. So 13% is not a bad place to be, and I can't imagine that we would go below even 10%. And in terms of the forensic team, yes, we are building it. For the moment, they are spending most of their time building their expertise in the context of the integrated audit with the multidisciplinary team. So there are few, if any, individual standalone forensics report. We believe that the real value that we can derive from those teams is that of them complementing the regularity auditors in the course of producing one ATSA audit. So I hope that does answer the question. Honorable Chair, I think I've gone through all of the questions in turn. Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, as those responses from questions or comments that we have made around the input by the AG, I still see hands here from Honorable Mlenzana and Honorable Singh. Are you still have issues to raise?
No, mine is an old hand. Sorry, picture.
Chairperson, good afternoon. mine is just to greet the AG and the health rate two issues. Let me appreciate the presentation, though I have to quickly run through it as I was getting responses because I joined late. I have started to date. That's why I want to appeal to you to pardon me for arriving this late. But that's two things. One, AG, how are your relations with SAPS outside this arrangement which came out due to COVID-related issues? Remember, we said that we would like to see a situation where you hold a quarterly also regular meetings with the SAPS. Then the second one would be on the COVID-related real-time audit activity, the one which related in the unfortunate situation of the 67 million, which is now deficit. How is AG claiming this amount? Is the AG filing some sort of claims in the form of figures per audit activity or what? I'm asking this chair because we have to understand, as she was saying, that if things do not go the way we would like in 2 or 3 weeks' time, we'll have to come in and assist. Thanks, everybody.
AG? AG?
Sorry, I was on mute. Thank you, Honorable Mlenzana. The relationship with SAPS has been most helpful in terms of shaping the responses to the threat and intimidation of our team. And I think it's one of the benefits of collaboration that has resulted in us reducing the instances of threat and intimidation, that and lockdown provision. We collaborate with them as we plan audits, as we get ready to send our teams out to specific areas in the country, and they remain ever supportive in terms of maintaining the safety of our teams. So I think that initiative that was led by Parliament about two years ago has paid off. Our duty now is to maintain that relationship and maintain that level of collaboration at national level, but also at provincial level. The provincial commissioners have been most responsive and have deployed even the officials at district level to support our team. In terms of the funding for the COVID-related work, we passed on to auditees as much as we could, but we had to absorb a cost of 160 million rand. What we will do, if that is okay with you, Chair, we can submit to you in writing a full account of what we spent, how we funded it, and what the shortfall is. That way there will be no doubt on what the expectation is and what the request is that we're making to the National Treasury, and also how you can support us.
Okay. In just elaborating a bit, AG, exactly on that point, would you highlight to members the resultant of such deficit of that amount, and therefore why you lay weight on what you are referring to in terms of the COVID-19 audit costs, one way or another. Thanks so much.
So when we started this audit work, it wasn't work that had been budgeted for either by us nor by the audit team. And we responded to a request specifically from the presidency.
And at that time, there was an understanding that whatever cost we incur, we will be able to get back. As life went on, I think it became quite clear that the pressures around the business were real. And as a result, a combination of us having requested the public audit act amount for support, which was the 50 million rand, as well as the support that Treasury continues to give in terms of the distress auditees, the financially distressed municipalities in particular, that can't afford our audit fees as per Section 23, they continue to support in that regard. So this was a new aspect, which was not planned for by anybody. So one of the reasons why it's taken a while for us to deal with it is precisely that. I remain hopeful that we'll be able to find each other in the coming weeks, especially as we are all heading towards the end of the financial year. And part of the reason, Chair, I'm suggesting that we give you a full write-up is that as we wrap up the financial year, we'll be able to give you a full account of what these audits have cost us. As you recall, we did work for PSMA when we reported on that with the special report number one. We followed up with special report number two, and we're now working on special report number three, which is focused on municipalities. So part of the challenge is keeping track of this number as it evolves. At the moment, we have calculated 150 million rand, and that's the number that we are looking for support from. However, as I say, it's going to be easier if I'm able to give you a full write-up of exactly what we spent and how we funded it.
Thank you very much, AG, and the honorable members. I hope that in covering questions and comments, we're able to arrive at a point which says then the committee could be able to sit and look into these matters and finalize the report for tabling to Parliament at appropriate moment, and thereafter set the office at ease in the areas that relate our emphasis in as far as our oversight is concerned. That needs our indulgence at a time which we are going to set for a meeting to deal specifically with these matters. Thanks to the clarity given by the Office of the Auditor General, which will enable us to take informed decision on these matters. If there is no further comment on what we have been dealing with, we have managed to save about 15 minutes of our time, which is a good thing, and we can adjourn the meeting. Except for there is anything that is in our own way. From my side, thank you very much, AG and your team, and thanks to the members of the committee and our officials for the work well done. We wish you a very fruitful weekend. Be safe. If you play safely. If you pray safely. If you drive safely. You must ensure that you observe all the prescripts that relate to COVID-19 aspect. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
Samuel,
good, Chair.